Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, and today I am bringing you another special live episode of The Weeds that we recorded last weekend at South by Southwest in Austin. This is a conversation with myself, Dara Lynn, Jane Costin, and Julian Castro. Julian was the mayor of San Antonio, a city that I happen to know and love pretty well. He was also Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Obama administration. He agreed to really get into the weeds with us on housing policy stuff, some of his ideas, some of his record in the Obama administration, his very game effort to explain some of the real nuances of tax policy, of regulations that get into this. It's a subject that's really near and dear to my heart. I think also an interesting conversation. He is, of course, running for president as well. Mentioned some of his bigger, bolder ideas on healthcare, immigration, priorities. After the second break, we've got some questions and answers from the audience that were really interesting. So I think you're going to like it. Here goes.
The weeds, everybody.
Thank you, guys. It's so great to be here. It's so great to be outdoors. Normally, podcast is just the three of us in a dark, windowless room.
And usually it's very hot in that room, and the takes are hot.
Fresh air, sunshine, and normally it's just the three of us kind of BSing around, but we've got a great special guest with us here today, make a special event for all of you. He was the mayor of San Antonio, a great city in which I have spent an incredible amount of time, as well as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under Barack Obama, a candidate for president in this 2020 cycle. Please welcome Julian Castro.
Hi, y'all. Hi, y'all. Good to be with you.
So thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us. Secretary agreed to, try to delve into the weeds, as we say here on housing policy. Secretary, I go to San Antonio a lot to visit my wife's family, and I live in Washington, D.C., and I sometimes sort of troll myself looking at the real estate listings in San Antonio and see how affordable the house is there in a city that has been growing a lot. It's not a depressed city. It's a lot of people are coming in. And, from your perspective as mayor there and then running national policy, what do you think, what's San Antonio doing right that some of the places on the coast could maybe learn from?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you all very much for having me out here. It's good to be with y'all. Hope everybody's enjoying South by Southwest. Yeah. I served as mayor of San Antonio from 09 to 14, and obviously very proud of the city. So what is San Antonio doing right, or what has the city done right when it comes to unaffordable housing supply? I think cities in Texas generally, one of the things that they have done fairly well, but is also double-edged, is, for instance, with zoning, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's Houston famously having almost no zoning, or cities like Austin or San Antonio, right, the cities have been hospitable over the years to the creation of a housing supply that also has stretched the city limits farther and farther out. But a byproduct of that has been that, people are able to find housing that is relatively affordable, within 15 or 20 minutes of the downtown area. I think another thing was that the city was good about setting up a housing trust fund in the late 1980s. It's relatively modest, but it indicated a willingness to work on affordable housing issues. and through the years has looked at local regulation and in terms of how it could be hospitable for the creation of affordable housing. So a number of steps that the city's taken.
Having gone from being mayor of San Antonio to running housing policy at the federal level, and now, of course, running for another federal office in which you're not necessarily going to be able to kind of tinker with zoning, you know, in every municipality, unless you have some kind of secret plan to rezone America, which this would be a great time to roll that out. Like, what in your experience are the things that federal housing policy can do to deal with, you know, both the variation from city to city and what the problems are, and the extent to which this is really an issue that historically state and local governments have had a lot of leeway in?
Well, you're right. And I mean, I don't want to dismiss the importance of local action, because in fact, y'all may remember that toward the end of the Obama administration, one of the things that the administration did directly out of the White House, in fact, right, was that it released a toolkit for local communities to digest and to try and put into action. I think it was like 15 or 20 different steps that local communities could take to try and create a better environment for affordable housing supply that had to do with land use decisions, right? So that's still important, but you're right. You know, I was in LA the other day, and LA has probably had the biggest challenge when it comes to unsheltered homelessness in the United States over the last 5-10 years. And that's not because LA hasn't tried to create more affordable housing supply and address unsheltered homelessness. In fact, LA County passed a couple of propositions just 2 years ago to try and do that. It's that it's bigger than any one community. So the federal government needs to step in a number of different ways, right? Like, I think that we should expand the low-income housing tax credit. I believe that we should expand the National Housing Trust Fund. The National Housing Trust Fund was inaugurated in 2015, but it was only $173 million. And it was special, it is special, because it's aimed at extremely low-income individuals, which are people making less than 30% of the area median income. You know, and it's increased since then, but what do we need to do? We need to make bold investments, and we need different mechanisms to do that, whether it's taking a greater transaction fee from the GSEs and amping up the National Housing Trust Fund. I think that Senator Warren has proposed some of this in her proposal, or making direct investments in things like home and CDBG, because if you index CDBG from 1978 to where it would be today, you know, it would be almost at $20 billion, I think, but it's at $3 billion.
Right. CDBG, for those of you playing along at home, community development block grants.
That's community development block grants. For those of y'all who have worked in cities, or you're, you know, I know we have a lot of folks that are familiar with urban planning and urban issues. Community development block grants are probably the favorite program of local officials all over the country. But we found that even though the program had been created in 1974 in part or largely out of issues related to housing, only 29% of the funds these days were going to housing related issues.
Right.
Right. So, you know, there are different investments that we can make from a federal level to increase housing supply. And then also, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, it's not just about increasing supply, it's also the dynamic of where housing is located, the Fair Housing Act, whether people can access housing. So there are different dynamics at work.
So do you see a linkage between some of the federal funding type stuff that you were just talking about, and earlier you were talking about local regulation and housing? Do you think there's a way policymakers can sort of put those two things together, or does it proceed on separate tracks?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that in our grant programs, for instance, that we need to find a way to incentivize the communities that actually are making it easier for affordable housing to happen and being courageous in their land use decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Because oftentimes it's NIMBYism,
right,
that stops affordable housing from getting created, especially in certain neighborhoods, but that affects the entire metro area. So I would like to see us get better about working with communities and rewarding the ones that are actually being courageous about creating affordable housing throughout their metro.
So you mentioned NIMBYism. I think that's particularly interesting because I think in a lot of quote-unquote liberal areas, we see that impacting where single families can live. You saw that in Seattle and a couple of other areas that are encountering extreme economic growth, but also having a housing shortage. And it's been interesting in my work. You know, my work is predominantly on conservatism and conservatives, and it seems that that issue is something that is a bipartisan problem and also one that, you know, Senator Warren, one of her housing proposals, also to do with the removal of certain housing regulations. What's your take on that, and how do you think that cities and through the federal government can kind of combat NIMBYism and kind of the zoning regulations that prevent more families from being able to live in more spaces?
Yeah, this is a very important point, right? And I saw this every other Thursday when I was a city council member and a mayor in San Antonio, is that obviously people naturally are concerned about what's going to go in their backyard.
Right.
All of us are concerned about, if you own property or even if you're just renting property, of course it's natural to be concerned about what's going to be right next to you, right? That
right.
impacts your quality of life. So people should have input into that. But we all know that oftentimes what that devolves into is a paranoia or a fear of the other, and oftentimes based in some sort of prejudice, sometimes racial prejudice, sometimes class-based prejudice, sometimes a combination of all of those things. And it doesn't matter whether people are Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, when it comes to those issues. I have
right.
seen in the most liberal communities, people stand up and say that we can't let this affordable housing go in because it's going to cause all these kinds of problems with crime and who are the people that are going to live here. And
change
so,
the character of the neighborhood.
Yeah, change the character of the neighborhood.
And we know what changes the character of a neighborhood means.
Yeah. Right. So, but I do think what we can do is that we can give local communities the tools to try and educate. And I wish I could remember the name of the suburb. When I was at HUD, one of the things that we did was we visited Minneapolis, and we talked to this suburb that was trying to educate its residents about the realities of people who live in affordable housing, in public housing, and in Section 8 housing, to essentially pave the way for better understanding so that you have less of that pushback. I wish one of the things that could happen more often is that kind of reality testing and education for people so that you don't get that irrational pushback as often or as furiously as you do right now.
So this kind of gets into something that I guess we're kind of backing into, even though it's a very important dimension of federal housing policy, is the kind of owner-renter distinction, right? We're kind of like framing this conversation as people who are generally owners, who have roots in the community, who are concerned about property values, being worried about people in affordable housing, people who are just renting or transient. A lot of federal housing policy is based on the idea that homeownership should be encouraged and promoted. And, you know, I think we've seen over the last decade some of the ways in which that has maybe, you know, we're beginning to see that getting called into question a little bit. Normatively speaking, do you think that homeownership is what we should be going for in housing policy, or do you think that we maybe need to like tweak the balance between encouraging people to own and or encouraging them to rent?
Well, I mean, I still see a value in home ownership, but I believe that we need a better balance, for instance, with the mortgage interest deduction and what we could do if we took a portion of that and we dedicated that to more supply out there, either in the mold of a National Housing Trust Fund or something that created more housing opportunity for people further down on the income scale, right? So I do think, I agree with a balance there, and in fact, if I remember correctly, former Congressman Keith Ellison had legislation that he
yes.
had proposed essentially to portion off some of that and to dedicate it to low-income affordable housing. I agree with something like that. I think we should do that. I do still see, though, a benefit to home ownership in terms of wealth creation and being able to hand down a piece of property to the next generation. As folks know, there's a huge wealth gap between communities of color and the mainstream community.
Right.
And so I do see home ownership as one way, one positive way, if it's done right, of helping to close that gap and give folks something that they can pass on to the next generation.
So one of the big things the federal government does in that regard is the GSEs, the government-sponsored enterprises, which they were created decades ago, right? These are basically institutions. They buy mortgages from banks. They package them. They sell them off. It was privatized, I think, in the Johnson administration. And then now two presidents ago, renationalized, and they've been kind of lingering now under government ownership. You supervised them, I guess, as head secretary. And what do you think? Like, what should be done with this? Is the status quo situation good? Should we accept that, or do we need to move back?
Well, you know, that change was born out of crisis,
yes,
right? In our housing crisis. And, you know, I do think that at the moment, you know, I haven't seen a compelling plan that has been put forward that would actually pass Congress to change that setup
right
now, right? And of course, during the Obama administration, there were different proposals that were made that went to Senate hearings and I think maybe a House hearing. I think, at least for the foreseeable future, that we're probably going to stay in the pattern that we're in right now. I believe, though, that there are ways that the GSEs can be better on some of these issues that we're talking about creating more housing opportunity for low-income Americans and for communities of color. They have changed some of the algorithms
yeah.
that they use, for instance, to try and encourage you know, banks to lend. So I'm not saying that I'm against change,
mm-hmm.
all change, but I think right now, at least, that there's probably not going to be a major change.
Well, that was going to be my follow-up is, you know, it was nationalized as a crisis measure, not as a sort of deliberate policy. But if they're going to stay in government hands, are there more reforms that should be made to how they operate so that this can maybe, you were talking about racial wealth gap, which a lot of that is driven by differential home ownership and the different price trends in different kinds of neighborhoods. I mean, are there things you would like to see GSEs do as they're under executive control?
Yeah, no, I believe that they should follow the lead of organizations like the FHA as they try and ensure that there's expanded home ownership opportunity, particularly for communities of color. You know, part and parcel of that is the product that is offered and is sanctioned essentially by the GSEs. But I believe that they can play a larger role there in encouraging lenders to move in that direction of offering more opportunity to low-income individuals and have an impact on communities of color and essentially African-American home ownership
right.
and Latino and Asian-American home ownership. And with Mel Watt, I thought that we had, and I do think that we've had, you know, a partner that was at least willing to work on those issues.
Yes.
I don't know what we're going to get now,
uh-huh.
But you know, I hope that they move in that direction.
I mean, that's probably not what Mark Calabria is going to want to do with that.
That's the feeling
I know.
That I have.
So, yeah, probably not. I imagine you disagree with a few different things the Trump administration has done.
Absolutely.
But
yeah.
I'm interested. What the tax bill that passed was obviously mostly tax legislation, but it had a lot of housing implications. And
well, especially insofar as like a lot of existing, I mean, we've already talked about both the mortgage interest deduction and the low-income housing tax credit. Like tax code has become a way to talk about how we encourage different housing situations.
Right.
Right. And what kind of housing is encouraged? Because we saw that with, you know, the most recent tax bill, it encourages people to buy more expensive homes.
Right. So, I mean, when you think about this, I mean, I know Democrats obviously not favored that legislation, but in terms of what you would like to see rolled back tax-wise, how that impacts low-income housing tax credit, things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think that this tax bill missed a tremendous opportunity to expand low-income housing tax credits and ensure that their value is protected into the future. When we were there, the Obama administration was proposing, or this started before I got there in 2014, but had proposed basically to allow states to use, to essentially get more low-income housing tax credits by using up unused portions of other federal tax credits
right.
and expanding the low-income housing tax credit by up to 50% of the allocation. And when we would press on that, the answer that we always got back from the Republican-controlled Congress was, well, you know, we're waiting for an overall tax break, tax overhaul.
Sure.
Right? And we're
yes.
still waiting, even though that was supposed to be the tax overhaul.
They forgot about it somehow?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the meantime, there was a tremendous amount of uncertainty going into that about the fate of the low-income housing tax credit.
Right.
now we have opportunity zones, but opportunity zones are not really focused on housing.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's a smaller, I think, going to be a smaller percentage of what comes out of all of that. You know, I don't think that it moved the ball forward, and in some ways, as you mentioned, really it created incentives in the wrong direction and did not do anything to address the dire need of people who are extremely low income or very low income. This is people who are under 60% of area median income.
Right.
It's like the rest of the tax bill. I think it went in the wrong direction.
Of course, I mean, this is something that is liable to happen, not only when you have legislation that has to, that, you know, often gets passed in a very short window of time and there isn't necessarily a lot of opportunity to dig through it, but also when you have vast tranches of federal policy that are being moved through the tax code to begin with, right? Generally, do you think that, you know, and maybe not even just on housing policy, but like this often comes up when we're talking about lots of other domestic policy issues as well, when we talk about, you know, poverty alleviation via the EITC, right, when we talk about family policy via the child tax credit. Do you think that the tax code is a good way to deal with all of this, or has it just kind of become an easy but maybe not ideal policy solution?
I think like a lot of things, it's mixed. You know, that there's compelling evidence, for instance, the child tax credit that you mentioned, that has actually benefited low-income families in very real and substantial ways, that it's been a powerful tool to help reduce poverty. Y'all had an article, I think, just yesterday or today about the Democrats' new proposal that Senator Bennett and Senator, I think, Sherrod Brown have supported, that I think is called the American Family Care Act. Or
American Family Act?
American Family Act, that essentially the main vehicle for reducing child poverty is through the child tax credit, and that's because in that case there is substantial evidence that that works. However, I also don't think that should be the limit of our efforts, because there are other ways that we need to make direct investments in communities, right? And also use other devices, for instance, that National Housing Trust Fund that looks at GSE transaction fees instead of the tax code.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics, or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's NAPP.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
So I want to back up just a little bit, because a lot, when we're talking about wealth disparities and housing disparities between white communities and communities of color, that was not created on accident. You know, that was through federal policy.
Yep.
So, you know, I'm interested to hear your thoughts, because we're still dealing with the legacy of redlining. You can see it here in Austin. You can see that basically in every major city. And when you ever want to know why a certain neighborhood is the way it is. So, you know, how do we, through federal policy, start to combat that legacy that was created, in effect, by federal policy?
Yeah, well, I mean, we took a major step in that direction, I thought, with this rule called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing that some folks may be familiar with. It basically was the first.
Can you explain that? I never honestly understood how that was worked.
Oh, is that right? Let me put my HUD hat back on.
Let's figure it out.
In 1968, when the Fair Housing Act was passed, the Fair Housing Act said it charged the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development with affirmatively furthering fair housing.
Right.
But that was never, codified in any kind of rule. There was never a rule that was promulgated that specifically and precisely identified what that meant.
Right.
In 2015, and it had been tried in 1997, I think, under Secretary Cuomo. The Clinton administration tried to get this over the finish line. We actually promulgated a rule called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing. And the issue here was, what is the obligation of communities that receive federal taxpayer dollars, when they receive those dollars, to ensure that there's equal housing opportunity throughout their jurisdiction? That includes how they're enforcing the Fair Housing Act, how they're spending their dollars that they get, right? So that there's opportunity among different communities in different parts of town. And what this rule said was basically, we're setting the standard high, we're giving you a whole bunch of data so you can figure out where your challenges are, what the problems mm-hmm. are, and then we're gonna set a higher standard for the plan that you have to give us in order to address these unequal housing opportunity. We saw this as a groundbreaking rule to basically further desegregate communities in the United States, right? And to offer housing opportunity to people who were trapped in low-income neighborhoods in, as Raj Chetty and his group of researchers had said, higher opportunity neighborhoods, right? So people would have better opportunity, and you'd also have, as a consequence of that, we thought, more integration in American communities. The first plan started rolling in, I think, on October 4th, 2016. Only from a few cities, because cities were going through a cycle of 5 years where they were due, you know, year one or year two, year three. And then when the administration turned over, we were all excited because we had just done this. When the administration turned over, the Trump administration put that on ice, basically.
Right.
And now these communities don't have to submit their plans. It's all on hold. And at HUD, I think, to answer your question directly, this is one of the things that we need to get back on track, because it may not make a difference, you know, in the first 5 years, but over 20 years.
Right, which is how you really have to think about housing policy, is that it takes place in 15, 20 year increments.
For sure. And you know, if you have real accountability there, then you're going to hold these communities accountable that are allowing a lot of still unequal housing opportunity and not policing discrimination the way that they should, and getting more serious about addressing those issues. That's what we wanted to see.
So the idea here is to basically to require cities to develop plans to take, like, active steps to do what?
A number of things. To address discrimination in housing, mm-hmm. to explain how the way that they're using their CDBG dollars or their home dollars or other federal money they get for housing, how that is consistent with equal housing opportunity within their jurisdiction. You know, for instance, let's say that you had a city that was spending all of its CDBG money in one area and not in another. That was also eligible.
Right.
You know, that might raise a question of fairness there.
Equity, right.
Also, more broadly, you know, you have these patterns within a metro area where low-income, mostly communities of color, are still very segregated.
Right.
And you have some places, some cities that still have, y'all remember the dissimilarity index or D index, right? Still have a very high D index, like Chicago, right? And how you would address essentially greater integration through your investments of federal taxpayer dollars over time.
I have a lot of sympathy for this model, and not least because, like, it reminds me of the Justice Reinvestment Initiative stuff that was happening at the same time on criminal justice policy, right?
Right.
The idea of, like, the federal government has the informational resources, we're going to give that data to you and leave it to you to figure out exactly how you're going to tackle these issues that we've set for you. Like, there are interesting federalism, like, implications there, but it also, you know, that does not appear to be the attitude that the Trump HUD has taken toward it. So I guess, and this is not just a housing question, but when you're talking about, you know, stuff that happened over the 2 years you were at HUD getting put on ice fairly immediately, and, you know, in a best case scenario, we're talking about getting back into office in 2021, how much of a problem does that kind of 4 year setback create for a 15 to 20 year cycle? And, you know, how can you make sure that things are moving forward on policy if so much of this has to be just like undoing the things that have been done?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm convinced that the next president is going to have to spend at least the first 2 years cleaning up the mess in these agencies that this president has created and trying to, you know, trying to get us back on the right track of actually expanding opportunity for everybody instead of narrowing it the way that this administration is doing. But I sense in the question, though, there are two things I wanted to comment on that. Number one, we saw how empowering it can be to give data, right, with all of the ways that data can be used. Now I'm thinking of the positive ways that data can be used by these local communities to better understand the landscape of opportunity and how they can increase it, especially for people who are low income, right? And communities of color that have often faced redlining and discrimination and, you know, underinvestment or disinvestment and white flight and everything else that has locked people into certain neighborhoods, especially in big urban areas. That's number one, the power of data. But secondly, you know, underneath that question, there's also, there is a question, I think, that's part of that, that, okay, well, and this relates also to how I think foreign leaders are thinking about the United States now, what they see how erratic this president has been, and they're thinking, well, are things going to change every 4 years or every 8 years? And the answer to that is that we have to find ways, part of the answer is that we have to find ways to institutionalize those positive changes much more effectively than we have so far, because we've seen how easy it is to pull that back, whether that was DACA, you know, in a different space,
right,
or it's affirmatively furthering fair housing. And that's hard because that often requires congressional approval to do it. This implicates issues like, should we have a filibuster or not in the Senate?
Should we?
I think you have to keep on the table.
Right.
Being able to do away with it. Yeah, no, I mean, if the question comes down to, are we going to have universal health care, or am I going to stick to 60 votes in the Senate, we're going to have universal health care for everybody in this country, you know? So, but I think that we do need to be smarter and sharper about how we institutionalize these positive gains that we make, so that you can't have somebody like Trump just come in and, you know, in an erratic way, start pulling all of it back.
I love how you successfully divined that that was, in fact, an immigration question.
Yes.
which I suppose is not the most surprising thing coming from me. I do want to, like, I could easily fill our remaining time just peppering you with questions about immigration, but I'm going to at least retain the housing nexus, because something that we've seen that a lot of the construction industry has really gotten very concerned about, not just the rescission of DACA, but also the Trump administration's efforts to end TPS. That's something that in the DC area, there's been a lot of concern about, you know, the construction workforce now not necessarily having work authorization. And, you know, that certainly does strike me as an issue where the uncertainty is creating a lot of problems, but temporary protected status was designed to be something where there was a lot of administrative flexibility. So when we're talking about issues that aren't necessarily housing policy, but where the idea of giving the industry regulatory certainty comes into play, is that something you're maybe looking at and going, maybe we do need to reduce the amount of uncertainty and flexibility in the regulatory state so that we can make sure that there's going to be a certain baseline understanding that, like, yes, you'll have your workforce going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now, I'll start this question in a little of a more global sense and then answer the question is, right now, I think one of the strongest arguments with the business community for not abiding by this administration for another 4 years is the massive uncertainty that it has created. I mean, I spent years in local government hearing from business that what they needed was certainty. Right? They didn't like what you're doing, but they needed certainty. And this guy has created more uncertainty on any number of different fronts than any president, I think, that we've seen in a while.
It turns out they'll settle for some tax cuts. They can't have certainty.
Yeah. Well, we'll roll those back, so that might make it a little bit more uncertain.
Yeah.
Temporarily. But, yeah, I mean, I think if you can achieve certainty not only, you know, from that standpoint, but also for the families that are impacted by TPS, I would like to see us be able to get more of those TPS families actually to become full-fledged citizens of the United States. I think that we need to increase the number of legal citizens that we're able to take into the United States and to undo the targeting of these TPS communities that the president has committed. I know that that's in litigation, and but my hope is that we can go back and create more certainty in different ways, including for the business community. The last thing I'll say about that is, you know, we're here in Austin in a community that is growing tremendously with a lot of construction going on here.
Yeah.
The construction industry is one industry that clearly relies, I mean, the fact is that they rely on undocumented labor.
Right.
Right? The construction industry, the farming, agriculture industry, the hospitality industry, whether people like it or not, they rely on undocumented labor. And our unemployment rate right now is 3.8%. And our birth rate has slowed down. We have examples around the world of countries like Japan that basically are in a position of having to beg for a labor force that is young enough to fulfill the needs of the nation. If we're not careful, then we're going to go in, you know, 20 or 30 or more years, and that's what we're going to become. And so when we look at a program like TPS, we need to structure it with that reality in mind. And that's how I would approach that problem.
So are you... We'll go off topic.
Yes.
You seem to be suggesting you want an expansion of legal immigration.
Well, I want an expansion of legal immigration, and I also want the opportunity for undocumented immigrants who are here, the 10 or 11 million people who are here, to have a pathway to citizenship.
I mean, that's been the...
That's
and by
we're
the way,
not breaking
and I would say
news
that those
here,
two
exactly.
things are not mutually exclusive. You know, like I recognize a lot of times when you tell people, well, we need to address the issue with undocumented immigrant families, and they say to me, well, what do you mean? You know, my family came in, they applied.
Right.
Sometimes they say, you know, I have an uncle or I have a cousin that's been waiting for 15 years. Like, what the hell are you talking about? And I tell people, those two things are not mutually exclusive. Right, we can both improve the legal immigration system and also address undocumented immigrants. And at the end of the day, to put an exclamation point on the point I was making, we are going to need these people for the future success of the country, right? We're going to need these folks for the future success of the country.
So when you talk about, you know, addressing the status of unauthorized immigrants, like, the way that people tend to talk about this is through some, you know, like legalization for those who are already here, providing a path to citizenship. But, you know, as we were just talking about with TPS, the situation of people who just do not have individually a way to apply for status is going to be an ongoing issue. So are we talking about just a legalization for those who are here and assuming that unauthorized migration will be reduced if we do the proper things to expand legal immigration? Or are there things that you're thinking about, like, all right, want cards on the table? I'm thinking about the changes made in 1996 with IRA-IRA in making it harder for people who had been in the U.S. without papers for 10 years to get cancellation of removal. And, you know, the various things that have happened that made it a harder line between unauthorized and legal immigration. Are you thinking that, like, we need a more flexible system so that somebody can, quote unquote, get legal more easily? Or do you think that if we just do the right things to legal immigration that won't be necessary?
No, I think that we need to consider all of that. Because, again, I believe that we're going to face a crisis in our country if we don't take in more people. And it's not going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years, but it's going to happen, you know, in the next couple of decades. and that we need to look at creating flexibility in the system. And it's also a matter of priorities, though, right? You know, if I believe that on January 20th, 2021 at 12:01 p.m., that we're going to have a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic House, and that the lesson of 2009-2010 on immigration reform is don't wait. and we're not going to wait this time. We're not going to wait, and I don't think that we should. And when we move comprehensive immigration reform, you know, we need to move it with an eye toward what our nation is going to need, not just in the next 5 years, but really over the next 50 years.
So I have questions I would like to ask, but I'm going to let
you do it.
We've seen some of the other candidates who are in the race talking like forthrightly. I mean, obviously, as one of the few non-senators running for president, the people who are in the legislative branch have been talking a lot about legislative priorities. And, you know, a couple have even said, like, yeah, you only get one or two big bills. Do you agree with that? And if so, are you saying that immigration is your one or two big bill?
I've said that the first major piece of legislation that I would put forward is on health care. And I would do that because that affects everybody. You know, that affects all Americans. I put immigration right after that because I see that as unfinished business that we need to address. And also, you know, who says that this is politician speak, basically, that you can only get like one done, right?
Uh-huh.
Because underneath that, what they're saying is that these politicians are going to freak out because they don't think that they can go to the ledge, to the edge of their political capital with their constituents more than once.
I thought you were making a joke about the legislative branch.
No, that's why I changed my wording. But that's what people are saying, is that, you know, well, I don't, you know, you're not going to be able to get more than one big thing. Is that, I don't necessarily think that that's true. Secondly, we need to try. Because part of the problem last time was that we didn't maximize 2009 and 2010 specifically on the issue of immigration, and we can't make that mistake again.
Texas, you know, is a place that has been growing a lot, right? These cities, Austin, tremendous amount of construction. San Antonio, I see new stuff coming up all the time. Houston, Dallas, and I think that's a subject where the ideas of housing and immigration really intersect, right? Because these are different policy silos in Washington, but they're both about, can communities change, right? And you have one form, a sort of a nativist backlash in the more conservative areas where people don't want foreigners coming in. But I see a lot in the coastal cities. I mean, there's literally in my neighborhood, people have lawn signs, one that says, you know, all are welcome here in five languages, and one that says, no new apartments on the Masonic Lodge grounds.
Are we getting Shawcast started in Austin, Texas?
Absolutely. No, and you know, what do you... Texas, conservative jurisdiction, but a place that has been open to changing, right? To, like, new people come here all the time, and I think it's seen as exciting. I see Texas politicians from both parties will brag that, like, oh, a lot of people want to come here. Like, that is good, right? And is... How do you think about that? I mean, in the rest of the country, in the mentality of the United States as a place that, like, wants things to change or wants, like, no one to be disturbed?
Well, I mean, I agree that Texas is the place to be, right? And a lot of people are moving into Texas. Ironically, politically, you know, the leaders of the state, Republicans, have spent a lot of time giving tax breaks to any number of companies. And now the workers that are moving into Plano or here in Austin or in Round Rock, like, they're voting Democratic. So they're changing. They're helping to change the political trajectory of this state. But, you know, that's still at a local level, at a neighborhood level. That does not mean that all of a sudden everybody is welcoming the idea of a whole bunch of affordable housing in their neighborhood. And here in Austin, we had a very good example of that. Code Next. Folks know there was a meltdown with Code Next. You know, Code Next was proposed basically as changing the development code. You know, one of the aims of it, at least as stated, was that it would increase the opportunity for more housing that was affordable, opportunity for people to live in different places. And for different reasons, that did not make it through. But okay. It got caught up in a lot of the back and forth and political debate. My hope is that some effort will get back on track, and maybe it already has. I can't say that I've been paying attention to it in the last couple of months, like, you know, with a magnifying glass.
Gee, I can't imagine why you might not have.
Have you been busy? What's
I've been a little bit busy. So, but some effort to ensure that Austin remains more affordable for people of different means. Because we've already seen in the last 15 years, the African American population in this city decline, I think, by 49 or 50%, right? And then just on an income level, like people are being moved out to Kyle and Buda and, you know, even further out. That needs to be addressed with something that is, I think, comprehensive at this local level. You know, people fall on different sides of that, like I said earlier, whether they're Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative. You almost can't tell where people are going to fall just based on their party label.
Right, yeah. Right.
My kind of last question for you would be that it seems that there is that divide because a lot of housing policy is on the local level. And I know we talked a little bit about how the federal government, what it can do in terms of addressing those issues on the local level, but it really does take those localities to put that forward. It takes the localities to use that data. It takes the localities to actually do something about it. And, you know, we see that the rates of African Americans living in D.C. and a lot of major cities, including in Austin. So I'm interested to see, you know, how much can the federal government really do to address inherently local issues on housing?
I think that we can do some because we can put teeth into the Fair Housing Act, right? So we can use our fair housing enforcement to address especially the most egregious examples either at a local government level or private level of discrimination and keeping people out and so forth. But the other way is really, you know, how you set your standards for the grants that you give out, where we make investments. So I think that we have some way to impact how housing affordability or housing opportunity happens, even though it is still very much impacted by the local level. And then, like I said, I mean, one of the good things of the Obama administration, one of the really clever things they did was on something like paid sick leave or any number of other issues, the $15 minimum wage, when they had red states that were in the way, right, so to speak, didn't agree with the policy, one of the things that Obama was good at was going to the Chicagos of the world or Seattle or LA or other big cities and to address these issues in a meaningful way. And so I think trying to work directly with these communities, with mayors and local officials that may be receptive on fair housing issues, I think that we need to do more of that.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Last week, Kanye West accused one of the biggest Twitch streamers of being an industry plant. It's an idea that comes up so often on platforms like TikTok and elsewhere.
You see people who have blown up seemingly overnight, and the question is, who's behind them, right? That's what everyone wants to know. Tipping the scales and pulling the lever to make them seemingly the next it thing on the internet.
This week on Power User, is it even possible to create an industry plant on the internet? And if so, how?
Okay, I think we've got time to try to take a few questions from the audience over there, maybe? Yes.
So I work for a local nonprofit, and we are focused on workforce development. So we do construction and healthcare certification trainings. And I was actually in a meeting this morning talking about 2-gen programming and how affordable housing is the number one issue to get individuals into continuing education and to get them to earn higher wages, right? So I guess my question is, how do you plan on combining all of those issues on a larger scale with community block grants? Because we do receive that as well, but it doesn't really make an impact.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, one of the things that I've been talking about out there is that when it comes to making policy, that we need to be much better about connecting the dots of how all of those things are related, right? A good example of this the other day, you know, I haven't had a chance to read it, but I think CityLab had an article on how high-speed rail could be great for more affordable housing opportunity, right? If we were to put that in across the country. You know, the relationship between housing and jobs and transportation and education and so forth. And so, you know, I do think that a community would do well to look at, like, if I could make one recommendation for a city or cities across the United States, it would be to literally for 6 hours on one day, get, you know, the head of the transit agency, the head of the housing authority, the head of the main school district, the community college district, the mayor, you know, the county executive, and then some community members together with maps of the city in different neighborhoods and the investments that are being made by local, state, and federal agencies, and then thinking through the future of how all of that can work together to create more housing opportunity, to create more employment opportunity, job opportunities. You know, how is there synergy between investments that are going to be made in infrastructure or transportation or something else? And to look at problems in that way. And at the federal government level, this is something the Obama administration was getting better and better about. It's how does the Department of Transportation work with HUD and the Department of Education and EPA? We had sustainable communities, for instance, that was EPA, HUD, and transportation, to incentivize communities to come up with plans that connect the dots in those ways, right? You know, I think that to the extent that happens, that we will be able to address that issue of affordable housing and connecting that to job opportunities.
So one of the few things the president can do is make appointments. So I'm curious, what are you looking for? Who would you appoint as your HUD secretary? If you want to throw in Secretary of State, AG, FEC, Supreme Court, feel free. But specifically that one, yeah, I feel you've got some experience.
Yeah, no, well, I would definitely start by appointing people that are qualified for the position to the position. Right?
I don't know what you're talking about.
That's an extremely hot take.
Yeah. I couldn't possibly know.
And I mean that with regard to several positions, appointments in the administration, but no, I mean, I think for HUD secretary, you want somebody that has experience either, you know, in housing or on urban development, because those are the two big areas writ large, or both of those things. You know, when I came in, for instance, I had a lot of experience on the urban development part, but less on the housing. I had to learn more about that. But you want somebody that has some expertise, some experience, and also the ability to synthesize information. Somebody that has the respect of, can gain the respect of a bureaucracy that in my case was 8,000 people and 54 different field offices, and marshal that to meet the mission of the organization. And so, you know, I don't have anybody specific in mind, but I think there are a number of different big city mayors, there are a number of people that have worked on housing issues that I would think about to appoint to HUD. And also, you know, somebody that has, aside from all of those things, real heart, because HUD is one of the agencies where you're serving poor people, you know, and you need to have a heart. One of my problems with this administration is that they seem to think that if you're poor, there's something wrong with you, and I disagree with that. I don't believe in that, and you need somebody who's very competent and can get the job done, but also that has a heart for the people that are being served.
Question. So I'm Andrew. So if president, what would you invest in to end homelessness?
Yeah, thanks a lot for the question. So, you know, one of the bright spots of the Obama administration was that in 2010, the administration released this plan called Opening Doors. And Opening Doors was groundbreaking because it was the first plan on homelessness that said, we're not just going to reduce homelessness, we're going to end it, beginning with veteran homelessness. And, you know, we didn't end veteran homelessness, but from 2010 to 2016, veteran homelessness fell by 47%. There were a lot of lessons there that we can apply to family homelessness, to chronic homelessness, to youth homelessness. So to answer your question about, okay, well, what would we do? We need to make big investments along the line that we've talked about today, from low-income housing tax credits to public housing units, including repair of public housing. And NYCHA is a good example of this. I mean, they're very far behind in terms of the quality of the units. two vouchers, Section 8 vouchers, all of those things. At the end of the administration in the last budget year, I believe that we submitted a proposal to spend $11 billion over 10 years to end family homelessness through a combination mostly of investment in vouchers and other types of housing opportunity that people, that families who were homeless could avail themselves of. I would use that and everything that we learned in our combating veteran homelessness to reduce homelessness or end it overall.
Hi there. So I'm currently writing my thesis on energy equity, and it seems that a lot of the renewable energy programs across states focus on home ownership rather than trying to expand access to renewable energy to all, whether they're renters or homeowners. What are some of the ways that we can further expand access to renewable energy across the country?
Yeah, thanks a lot. You know, there's some interesting things that that different public housing authority or housing authorities across the country that deal in public housing have done. From something as simple as Denver putting solar panels on a lot of their public housing complexes, to NYCHA, or New York's housing authority, that was doing retrofits to reduce carbon emissions and to reduce energy consumption. I'm also interested, for instance, in local utilities. Like, one thing I see very clearly is that if you belong to a community like Austin does, where you have a local public utility that is not an IOU, that is not an investor-owned utility, there is so much that you can work on to empower both homeowners and non-homeowners, renters, for instance, a distributed energy model on solar, right? And who actually is able to put that on their home? Like, is there a way to empower renters to do that? Of course, you know, that you have an issue with landlords there too. But same thing for apartment buildings, right? If I were a policymaker that was starting and trying to figure out how to bring solar to the masses, for instance, I would start with those publicly owned utilities like San Antonio, like Austin, like LA, and a few others, and see what they could do to jump beyond just working with homeowners, right?
Hi, Julian. I'm from the city of Corpus Christi, and there in Corpus Christi, we have the Port of Corpus Christi, the Port of Corpus Christi is the energy port of Americas, and we get a lot of energy from Permian Basin and the oil industry. The Green New Deal might affect that a lot, and I wanted to know what your thoughts are on the Green New Deal and environmental policies that are good but also don't affect the economy, like for where I'm from.
Yeah, no, thank you for the question. I like the outlines of the Green New Deal. I think, you know, between the time of proposal, where it's at now, and what would actually become legislation, of course there would be a lot of compromise in what that actually looks like. I agree with many of the aims of the Green New Deal. I also believe that there are ways to do this where we both create jobs, right, create economic opportunity, and also you're able to protect the planet. Here in Texas, for instance, we're the leader in the wind energy industry. Yeah, we're growing in terms of solar, right? We have jobs also in a number of other parts of the energy industry, including in your neck of the woods. And those jobs, I think, you know, they're not going to go away overnight. And we want to figure out ways so that in the future, that people still have a job in the energy industry, right? And I think they will, right? At the same time, I do think that over time, we want to transition to cleaner sources of energy. People can agree on that. It's just, how do we get there, right? And then I believe whether it's, you know, in the next 10 years or the next 20 years or 25 years, that we do need to move along the path of getting cleaner and cleaner. But that doesn't mean that people are not going to have a job in the energy industry, because I do think that as we move more toward renewable energy, we've seen that those jobs are going to exist, right? They already do. They're some of the fastest growing jobs in the country. So whether it's in your area or, you know, in Iowa, which I've been spending a lot of time in, right, where they also have a lot of wind energy.
What's so appealing about Iowa as a state?
Huge fan of Iowa Hawkeyes basketball.
I was going to say, not the negative 11 degree wind chill, that's for sure. Yeah, those jobs are going to be there. Okay. And this is not something that is going to, you know, this transition is going to happen, but it's not going to happen overnight. And it's going to happen with an eye toward maintaining the economic viability of regions and people's jobs, at least in the way that I see it. It's all about how do you make that real, right? How do you make sure that you can both create and sustain jobs and also reach your goals? And I don't think that those are mutually exclusive. I think that we can do both of those things.
All right, I think we got time for one more. So, you know, let's make it a good one if we can.
What, if anything, about your foreign policy views make you unique among the Democratic field in 2020?
Okay, nice.
Well, I don't know
one.
Because I don't think that, you know, I don't think that we've heard everybody's foreign policy kind of views, right? We've heard a lot more about domestic policy. I can tell you quite kind of what I think, my outlook. You know, as I see it, you know, we're going to lead in the United States. The United States, especially since post-World War II, has played this role in the world of standing up for the values that we believe in, freedom, democracy, opportunity, but to do so in a way, I think, that does not mean getting involved in conflicts or engagements that we should not, the Iraq War being the best example of that, right? We do need to repair the relationships that this president has undermined, whether it's with individual countries like Germany, right, or even France and Great Britain, or with alliances like NATO that have helped keep us safer in the post-World War II era. We also are going to compete. I agree with those that say that we always need to make sure that the American worker and American companies benefit first before we ever go into any kind of trade agreement, right? However, we also are operating in a global economy, right? We're not going to change that. You know, we have a global economy. And the question is, how do we compete in a way that is going to make sure that our people here succeed the most in that global economy? And by that, I mean workers in the United States, not just corporate profits, but workers in this country. The other thing is, we're going to compete. We're also going to better police people who cheat. You know, people have pointed out China and others that, and also within our trade agreements where there hasn't been adequate enforcement of those agreements. I think when it comes to labor standards, environmental standards, and enforcement standards, our trade agreements need to be stronger than they have been in the past. But I'm not somebody that just swears off the idea of, you know, either bilateral or multilateral trade agreements. I can see value as long as we come out ahead, there's mutual benefit, and also we lift up the labor and environmental standards and the enforcement standards in those agreements. The last thing I'll say is that, you know, I'm excited about the prospect of taking a longer view toward especially Mexico and Latin America, because all of these people that are showing up on our doorstep from these Northern Triangle countries, you know, whether they're coming from El Salvador or Guatemala or Honduras, they're coming to the United States because they can't find safety and they can't find opportunity in their home country. If they could find that in their home country, I believe that they would stay there and make a good life. We need to be a more constructive part of helping them find that opportunity for safety and for opportunity in their home country. And to really do a gut check on the way that we have treated a lot of these Central American countries over the years, because the United States has this checkered past of involvement in these places that in many ways sometimes has made it worse over the years. We need a new relationship with Mexico and with Latin America that is mutually beneficial, that will help ensure that they find safety and opportunity there, but that will not, you know, prop up leaders that take their countries in the wrong direction like we sometimes have before. All right.
Okay. Thank you so much, Secretary Castro. Right. Thank you all for being
here.
I see they're glaring
much.
At us
thank
from backstage.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you all very right. much.
Thanks, y'all.
All
hey, right. Thank y'all very much. Thanks okay. a lot.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
All right, folks, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed that special live interview with Secretary Julian Castro. I also want to let you know we're conducting an audience survey to help us serve you guys better. It's going to take like 5 minutes of your time, and I think it's going to be worth it in terms of letting us do a better job in the future. You can find the survey at voxmedia.com/podsurvey, and the Weeds will return next Tuesday back to our regularly scheduled program.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.